This is the Talking Tigers Podcast, presented by the Alabama Department of Public Health. Don't wait. Vaccinate. Protect yourself and others against COVID and flu. For more information, visit alabamapublichealth.gov/IMM. Here's Andy Burcham with another Talking Tigers Podcast.
He came to Auburn in 1973. As a freshman, he walked by J&M Bookstore and heard Gary Sanders call a punt, Bama punt. After a brief stint in radio, Jeff Miller settled into his career as a sports writer. That call and that team, the 1972 Amazons, always stuck with Miller, so much so that he wrote the book Teammates for Life. It took years of research and interviews and was just published this fall. Jeff Miller, author of Teammates for Life, is featured in this Talking Tigers podcast brought to you by Alabama Public Health. Welcome to the Talking Tigers podcast. Very glad to have with us today author, journalist, Jeff Miller, who has written a book about Auburn's 1972 Amazons called Teammates for Life. Jeff, good to have you with us today.
Thank you so much, Andy. It's a pleasure to be here. I did not grow up in the South, and in high school was not much of a college athletics fan, almost exclusively pro sports. I arrived at Auburn as a freshman in 1973. I was aware that Auburn had beaten Alabama 17-16, was unaware of the details until I came to freshman orientation. And I believe I was walking outside J&M Bookstore when the outside PA came on, and I heard the Gary Sanders Gusty Year Out record, instant replay, and learned just how amazing that victory was in that entire season, I soon learned. And then, of course, beginning in the fall of 73, the Iron Bowl tipped in the other direction for 9 consecutive years, beginning in that 73 season of 35-0. Very few of those were nail biters. 74 of particular interest was the 17-13 game that I witnessed from, I believe, the lower east stands of Legion Field, with the Thomas Gossam, Mike Washington touchdown that wasn't a touchdown. So it seemed to me like in each of those 9 years, the 72 win just became greater and greater, at least in my mind. I left school early because I went a couple of summer quarters. I just liked being there so much, I didn't feel like going home. Arriving in the fall of 73, I graduated in December of 76, I'd worked at the campus radio station, and then also WAUD, then out on South College. Did the baseball games in 75 and 76, 76 being the World Series trip. Starting the 77 season, when I decided to go into sports writing with an opportunity at the Huntsville Times, where John Pruitt was the sports editor. In journalism in Huntsville, later Jacksonville, Florida, and then in Dallas, where I've been since 1987. For years and years, I just thought back to that 72 team. And it was probably four or five years ago that I decided, if I'm ever going to take a good look at this, I'd better do it in time for the games, for the Punt Bama Punt 50th anniversary, December 2nd of 72. Barely got that done. The book came out in early November, and it became a much broader story than I ever anticipated. When getting to know these former players and their families and friends, just how much they have meant to each other through the years since they played their last games together.
Before we talk a little bit more about the book, where was home for you, Jeff, and why Auburn?
I grew up in North Jersey, where, at least at the time, there were no real strong ties. It wasn't like you grew up and you wanted to go to Rutgers or Penn State or any other school in the area. I have one sibling, an older brother, 3 years older, who went to Georgia Tech as an engineering student. So I started to follow tech some in my limited college interest, and made the decision, you know, what the heck, it would probably benefit me to get away from home, really get away from home. And I applied only to schools in the Southeast, if you define the University of Maryland being the Southeast. That was the northernmost school, and really just sort of picked Auburn out of a hat. My guidance counselor had recommended Auburn as one of a handful of schools once I told him my geographical interest. And at the time, picked Auburn, as I said, really for no particular reason. Once I got there, it was just a wonderful experience. Back then, so I lived in Mag Dorm for 1 year and met friends who I'm still friends with today, including a brother-in-law who was my resident advisor. The girl that he was dating, I married her younger sister. So there you have it. Auburn for life.
Who'd you do the baseball games with, Jeff?
Well, when I was at the campus station at Regal, I was working with Steve Copeland was my sidekick. I believe he was from Anniston. And then at WAUG, there was Bill Cameron and Don Phelps. And we did the games in 76 when Auburn won the regional. Back then, the SEC was a winner of each division, best of three. Auburn went to Kentucky and lost, I think, in the bottom of the ninth. Came home and swept. And then it was simply to a four-team regional, which was in Tallahassee, FSU, Jacksonville, and Middle Tennessee. Auburn won the regional. And I remember what I consider sort of my big-time announcing highlight of my career, which never advanced beyond college, was having Joe Beckwith, the winning pitcher, come up to the booth for a live post-game interview there at Florida State. So for the World Series, for the College World Series, Lee Haley was the athletic director, and he generously paid for one student announcer to make the trip, along with one member from the university staff. He chose a gentleman who worked in university relations named Paul Ellen, and that was the first time that Paul and I got together, and similarly, we've been friends ever since.
All right, when you started down the road, Jeff, to write this book, I mean, was it simply at that time to look back at the punt Bama punt game, and then it went from there, or how did the book start for you?
Well, the game was obviously right at the core, but I intended to look at the entire season, realizing what a journey of surprise achievement that was for that team. That's how it unfolded from the beginning. But of course, with certain people on that team that led to areas that really cried for more detail. So for instance, the senior fullback on that team, who was plowing many of the holes for Terry Henley to lead the conference in rushing, was James Owens. He was a senior, and that was the conclusion of the career of the first African-American scholarship football player at Auburn. So it behooved me to look into the details, not only of his arrival on campus, but also Henry Harrison, the basketball player who preceded James by 1 year when he came in from Bology to be the first scholarship athlete, period. And then I just decided, what the heck, I've gone this far. I would like to write about the history of racial integration of SEC athletics, which led to looking at the football program at Kentucky, the basketball program at Vanderbilt, and also the fact that the first black athlete in the Southeastern Conference was a baseball player at Tulane, because Tulane was still a year or two away from leaving the SEC back in the mid-60s. And so those kind of things grew. Being that Punt Bama Punt was at the center, I wanted to look at the history of the Alabama rivalry. You know, much has been done on that. An entire book has been written on the rivalry itself. But I just wanted to give the reader who might not be familiar with the history the chance to know how the series began, how Auburn football began, and of course the abyss there from the 19, I guess 07 it was, the last year that they played, until getting hooked back up there in the late 40s.
All right, why the title of the book, Teammates for Life?
Well, initially, I was working with the fact that I was going to use something like Amazin, since that had been the nickname given to the team early in that season when they began the year unranked, and then the third game of the season, still unranked at 2-0, they knocked off fourth-ranked Tennessee and entered the poll for the first time. So for much of the time, I was looking at that. But then as I began to spend time working on this and was part of email threads running back and forth among so many players, I noticed that Roger Mitchell, who was a junior on that team, he was a substitute in the secondary. He would play almost as much as the starters. And back then, Auburn used a three-man secondary with two defensive backs that they called side backs and one safety. Roger Mitchell signed all of his emails TMFL, Team Mates for Life. And that's where the title of the book came from.
How long did you research this before you started actually writing the book, or did you do both at the same time?
Yeah, I worked probably a year and a year and a half, almost 2 years, on research and interviews. And I live in Texas, and so for almost all of my in-person interviews, I was either getting on a plane or getting in the car and going to, whether it was Birmingham or Hainesville, Alabama, to go talk to Dave Ryan, or the Gulf Coast to get with Tom Gossin and Chris Wilson. So I was doing a lot of research. I was on a first name basis with people in libraries who were in the microfilm machines. So I get dug in on the research part so much that sometimes I forget, you know, I better start writing this thing or it'll never get done. And so that the writing began late last year. So it's been, and then I was pretty much done by the spring, and the editing process took a matter of months, and the book was finally published in early November.
What stories from the book, Jeff, surprised you?
Some of them weren't, I guess they wouldn't have been surprised if you were following the team at the time. First, you look at how Coach Jordan approached the season. Initially, the season was supposed to start on September 23rd against Chattanooga for the home game before playing Tennessee in Legion Field. If that schedule, with the way the schedule was, that game at Legion Field would have been Auburn's second game and Tennessee's fourth game. Because way back when there was only one, maybe two games televised nationally on a Saturday by ABC, and they would get together in the spring and decide their television schedule, ABC talked to Tennessee and Georgia Tech about moving their game from the middle of October to early September. So that became kind of a national opener on September 9th, and that gave Tennessee games against Tech, Wake Forest, and Penn State before playing Auburn. Coach Jordan was not enamored with that idea, and in the offseason, with the cooperation of Mississippi State, The SEC allowed them to go ahead and move the game that was traditionally played in mid-November to September 9th. So that put Auburn and Tennessee on equal footing, at least when it came to when their preseason practices would begin. And the advantage was decreased that it would be Auburn's third game as opposed to Tennessee's fourth. So that was one element that came into play. Some of the little things that come along, for instance, fans will remember that the little kicker from Atlanta, Gardner Jett, was such an important part of that team as a senior. Here's a guy who came as a walk-on and as a sophomore, still a walk-on, all Southeastern Conference as a sophomore. Now he's a senior, going into his senior year and a vital part of the team. And in the A-Day game, during a field goal attempt, he got whacked in his kicking leg by Ken Burnage. I can't imagine that happening these days. It was a different era in many ways. And he had an injured right knee. And he consulted with Dr. Houston from Columbus, Georgia, who told Gardner, you have two choices here. We can do surgery here, and 100%, you're going to be better off, but you're going to miss this 72 season. You'll be back in 73. Mm. Or you can work on rehabbing it and see how it works out. Well, so for Gardner, one of the reasons he chose to walk on at Auburn as opposed to Georgia Tech, where he had an older brother who went to Tech. He grew up going to games at Grant Field, but when he went on a walk-on visit there, he was told, we will probably redshirt you right off the bat. That'll give you 5 years to play four seasons of college football. And Gardner wasn't interested in going to college for 5 years. He wanted to get it done in four. That was much of the reason why he chose Auburn. And that played into his decision to rehab the leg over the summer of 72. And son of a gun, he came back as strong as ever and kicked that vital field goal that in the Iron Bowl that pulled Auburn within 16-3, which led to booing from both sides of Legion Field, because Auburn fans thought that their team had given up, and Alabama fans were upset that Auburn was now under the point spread. And then he kicked the last two extra points, including the winner for 17-16.
As you researched this book, and of course, Coach Jordan had long since passed, what kind of perspective did you get from the coaches? What kind could you get from the coaches?
I met with Tim Christian, who was a receivers coach then. I met with a member of the staff, Herb Waldrop, who still lives there in Auburn. But other than that, it was just going through the newspaper clips of the day. I also met a couple of times with Ralph Jordan Jr., who lives primarily in the Knoxville area, but they still have the Jordan home there on Woodfield Drive. And they come down often, obviously, during the season. So that was kind of the next best thing of getting Coach Jordan's thoughts and feelings. And so that's where most of that came from, Andy.
What did the guys say about the LSU game, the only loss of that season?
Well, in the modern vernacular, I think they sufficiently flushed it. That was for the third week in a row, they were playing a team who had the longest winning streak in the nation. First, it was Tennessee. They won that game 10-6 in Birmingham. Then Ole Miss had the longest streak, and they were playing the Rebels in Jackson. And that was their second trip to Jackson. That's where they began the season against Mississippi State. And won 14-3 when they went into the game with only five offensive plays. And I'm not sure they used all of them. They beat Ole Miss 19-13. Mike Neal had a big play late in the game that helped end an Ole Miss comeback attempt. So then it was on to Baton Rouge, and yet again, the longest winning streak in the country. LSU was ranked number 8 at the time. Auburn had moved up in the rankings after they finally got in after the Tennessee win at number 17. And then after beating Ole Miss, they went up to number 9. So it was 8 LSU against 9 Auburn. LSU came out hot, and that's Burt Jones was a senior quarterback who would be the number 2 pick in the NFL draft the following spring. Yet he divided time with a quarterback named Paul Lyons. And I watched the game. I watched all of the games. And it was just a head-scratcher to me that, you know, here you have a talent like Burt Jones in late first quarter, early second quarter. He's on the bench. Paul Lyons is in. And it's not like it was a situation where here's Burt Jones, your throwing quarterback. Here's Paul Lyons, your running quarterback. Now, they both had similar skills. But I did catch up with Burt Jones, and I tried to tactfully ask him, why in the world were you sharing time with Paul Lyons? Not to disparage poor Paul. Well, Burt Jones said, well, earlier in Charlie McClendon's career as coach at LSU, he at one point had put all his quarterback eggs in one basket. And then when that guy was hurt, he had to come out of a hole and couldn't get it done. So that's why Burt Jones, number 2 pick of the Baltimore Colts, was on the sidelines for much of that game. He got him off to a quick start. It was 14-0. Auburn did answer with a touchdown, but things got away early in the second half. And one of the interesting aspects of that game was that some younger players got into action for the first time that season who would be contributors down the road. One of them was Lee Gross, who was an offensive lineman, primarily playing center, but could also play elsewhere on the offensive line. Another was a running back named Chris Linderman. Now, he didn't have a long Auburn career. He left before his senior year. He was startled on the sideline. He hadn't played the first 4 games, and he thought he was going to be redshirted and out for the entire year. So Terry Henley had a huge load at running back. As it turned out, by season's end, one-third of Auburn's offensive plays were handoffs to Terry Henley. And so I think it was Claude Tsai was the assistant coach on the sideline who came over and grabbed Linderman and said, "You're in." And he couldn't believe it. So Linderman goes in, has a good showing. Auburn does lose the game 35-7. But Linderman then played a role in the following win at home against Georgia Tech. He was valuable a couple of weeks later at Florida when Terry Henley was injured in the first half and missed the rest of that game. And the next game was against Georgia, and Henley was out, period, and Linderman had a terrific game. The first 2 snaps of the Auburn offense after starting the initial drive of the game at the 27, Linderman cut right for 26 yards, and then from the Georgia 47, he took it, he cut inside, he goes to the outside, he goes 47 yards for a touchdown. So 2 plays into the game, Chris Linderman, the backup tailback, has 73 yards and a touchdown, and Auburn went on to win that game and clinch the Gator Bowl berth.
It's a great day for Auburn Tigers to get vaccinated. COVID and flu vaccines are an important tool to help stop the pandemic. The Alabama Department of Public Health is offering the COVID and flu vaccines to anyone 6 months and older. COVID and flu are still on the rise. Don't let COVID and flu stop you from supporting your favorite team. Continue to help protect yourself, your friends, and our campus by getting the COVID and flu vaccines. For more information, visit alabamapublichealth.gov/IMM. All right, let's get to the punt Bama punt game. Going into that game, I mean, very few people gave Auburn a chance to win it. How did it happen?
You know, back then there was the standard off week between the Georgia and Alabama games. I must confess, I missed the days when the Georgia and Alabama games were either both at home or both on the road, and there was a week in between. Progress moves ahead, and the schedule was compressed a little bit when the SEC championship game came into being with the expansion of the league in 92. But during the off week, Bear Bryant spoke at a quarterback club meeting in Birmingham. And at the time, when bowl shuffling, bowl negotiations were much more fluid than the setup that we have today, much of college football was surprised when he chose to play Texas in the Cotton Bowl instead of playing either Nebraska in the Orange Bowl, which would have been a rematch from the previous season, or Oklahoma in the Sugar Bowl. So Paul Bryant goes to this meeting, and most of the talk is about Texas instead of the upcoming Iron Bowl. And he says how, you know, let's forget Texas. I'd much rather beat that Cal College. Now, at the time, you know, obviously we had no Twitter. We had no, you know, internet and all that. It wasn't really that big of a deal. I went back and looked at the newspaper coverage the following day in both of the major papers back then in Birmingham, the Birmingham News, and at the time they had the Post Herald. And in neither of those pieces written from that quarterback club meeting was that really a big deal. It was just kind of, in other news, Coach Bryant referred to Auburn as a Cal College, and people thought that was pretty funny. Well, back when those newspapers made it to the lounge at Sewell Hall, they did not think it was very funny. In particular, Terry Henley, who had become kind of the de facto spokesman for the team. And it's worth noting, briefly with Terry, he was not camera shy. He loved the media attention and still does today. And that's a major part of those guys who have come through all the years together. But it's also worth noting the family dynamic that Terry came from. Terry's mother was married at 15. She was 17 when he was the first of three boys born. And within a few years, she was a single mother. And Terry has told me that often through the years, he would only half jokingly joke with his mother, you know, we kind of grew up together. So and Terry had a maternal grandfather who was a big Auburn fan. And Terry was growing up in Oxford, Alabama. And that's where his love of Auburn started. And I think his personality was shaped greatly by the family dynamic back then, where, you know, he was the oldest male in the house at a very young age. You know, Terry became quite a force of personality. And he was one of the ones there at Sewell Hall who said, Cal College, you know, we're not taking this sitting down. Now, Alabama, of course, was undefeated, number two in the country. And Terry came out and said, well, we're going to beat the number two out of Alabama. You know, the tide was, depending on your reference point, the tide was favored by either 14 points or 16 points. The Auburn offense was run heavy. Randy Walls was their sophomore quarterback who succeeded Pat Sullivan. And he had begun spring practice, depending on your depth chart. He was either fourth or fifth on the depth chart. On the first day of spring practice, the number one, Ted Smith, suffered a leg injury and never played that year. As spring practice progressed, Dave Lyon won the job. And then in the final scrimmage 3 days before A-Day, he suffered a knee injury and he never played that year. And Randy Walls comes away. In today's verbiage, I guess they would call him, what, a game manager? You know, just don't make any mistakes. And Randy was terrific at that. And you look at the numbers and you compare, and it was really a different sport to today's flinging it all over the yard. So in an Alabama game, Auburn is behind at halftime. And each team, Alabama was running a wishbone then, chug, chug, chug down the field. In the first half, each team had thrown one pass. Randy Walls had thrown one pass. Terry Davis for Alabama had thrown one pass. Each was intercepted. Okay, so we go into the second half. Neither quarterback has completed a pass. Alabama builds a 16-0 lead, and it's important to look at after the first touchdown, in the first quarter, but the extra point was blocked by Roger Mitchell, mostly shrugged at the time. And Roger Mitchell had also, the previous season, blocked an extra point in the big showdown game at Georgia, undefeated Auburn, undefeated Georgia, at the time called the biggest game in Southeastern Conference history, a name that lasted only two more weeks. And it was after Roger Mitchell's block of that PAT that Auburn turned around and Pat Sullivan hit Terry Beasley for a big touchdown that gave Auburn a comfortable lead and went on to win the game, and is often said to have clinched the Heisman Trophy for Pat. So it's 16-0, and now Gardner Jett comes in for that 42-yard field goal attempt early in the fourth quarter, and Coach Jordan says, "Gardner, can you make it?" And he says, "I think so." And Coach Jordan says, "You think so? Get in there." And he makes the kick, 16-3, 5.5 minutes to play. Alabama has to punt. There was a blocking mix-up in the Alabama line. Alabama had a freshman playing left guard, and it's worth noting that back over in the winter that the NCAA had allowed freshmen back in varsity competition in football and basketball for the first time since the Korean War. So Alabama had a left guard freshman. Up until the last few minutes, Auburn always had the punt return on, and there's a certain offensive blocking scheme for that. Well, now Auburn has the punt block on, and Alabama had a different blocking scheme where everybody's supposed to block out. Left guard did not block out. And so as the left tackle is blocking out and the left guard is either just moving forward or holding steady, that created the hole that Bill Newton came through, blocks the kick around the 20, 25-yard line. It's bouncing on the artificial turf of Legion Field. David Langner, a junior defensive back who's lined up on the far right side, grabs the bouncing ball, runs in, PAT, now it's 16-10. So this game was not on television because nobody back in the spring at ABC thought that Auburn was going to be giving Alabama a competitive game. And back in those days, you know, the assistant coaches are just sitting up there in the booth there high atop the west stands of Legion Field. So as Langer had been charging in from the right, Roger Mitchell charging in from the left, the Alabama side assumed that one of those players had blocked the kick. So a few minutes later, now it's 1.5 minutes to play, and Auburn has stopped Alabama with Mike Neal making a key tackle of Terry Davis on third down. And you can look back and say, Auburn's offense had done nothing all day. If Alabama had just run a fourth down play and given Auburn the ball on downs at midfield, it's hard to say that Auburn could have put together its first touchdown drive of the day. But that didn't happen. Greg Gant, the Alabama punter, was given instructions, two things. First of all, move up closer to the line. And second of all, just get it away no matter how you do it. You know, if it goes 10 yards, that's good enough. And ironically, Greg Gant was a high school teammate of David Langner's with the Woodlawn Colonels there in Birmingham. Well, by all accounts, Greg Gant did not shorten up his stride, his move, his windup, whatever you want to call it. He took his full steps. He did move up closer to the line, but Newton came through the same hole. If he didn't get it, Ken Burnage probably would have gotten it. From high in the announcing booth at Legion Field, Gary Sanders and anybody else who had been looking from that angle, all they saw was number 25 high in the air, Roger Mitchell. And so in the radio call, Roger Mitchell gets credit for blocking the kick. But essentially, the same play took place. Newton has blocked the kick. It bounces into the hands of Langer, who runs it in. Gardner Jett kicks the point to make it 17-16. Alabama's got time now, not much, and especially when you're running the wishbone. And now they must pass for the first time in the game. Terry Davis is looking for Wayne Wheeler, their star receiver, across the field on the left side. Swooping in for his second interception of the game was David Langer, and that was the end of the game.
Do you think that these guys have any idea the legendary status that that game would have and would probably still be considered the greatest finish to an Auburn-Alabama game until the kick six in 2013?
No, I don't think they had any idea of what it would be all these years later. For one, as I mentioned, not losing them 9 years in a row kind of elevated that game in the short term. But then you're right. I look back at the finish in 2010 in Tuscaloosa when the stakes were so high, much higher on the Auburn side of things. And then if you look at the single most, I'm not sure the word dynamic play in Auburn football history coming from, 9 yards deep in the end zone. But even with that, I will counter and say that the circumstances of these two blocked kicks in the final 6 minutes of a game against an undefeated opponent looking to win a national championship, how they happened, the fact that Bill Newton had come to Auburn as a walk-on, he has a fraternal twin who was given a scholarship, Bob Newton, dearly wanted to play Auburn football, came, won a scholarship, becomes a starter, and then has these two plays. It might be an exaggeration to say they changed his life, but it really did alter the course of his life, where he's Bill Newton, the guy who blocked the kicks all these 50 years later. Many of these players get together annually. One of the reserve tight ends on that team named Mike Gates, who lives in Mobile, has a cabin. Cabin really isn't the best description. It's a large cabin. It looks like a meeting hall, way out in the woods, in a town of Pineapple, two words, Pineapple, Alabama, just west of I-65 between Mobile and Montgomery. And these guys get together there for a weekend every spring, and they do some fishing. They go out in the woods. They, in some ways, they're in their 20s again, goofing around, pouring cold water on somebody who gets out of a shower. And in other ways, they are men in their 70s who are comparing their prescriptions and their joint replacements and the like. They're really quite a group.
Jeff, how can folks buy the book?
Well, it's available on Amazon. It should be available on Barnes & Noble. The website for the publisher is Archway Publishing, which is the same entity that last year did David Housel's Back Booth at Chappie's book. I do have a signing scheduled for J&M Bookstore on December the 10th, Saturday, December the 10th, which Trey Johnston has reminded me is graduation day, should be good traffic. I'm hoping for some players to be there. I'm pretty sure Roger Mitchell will be there, but that's the best way right now.
Jeff, thank you very much. One, for being with us today. And two, for writing this book. I can't wait to read it.
Well, thanks, Andy. It's been a pleasure.
War Eagle.
War Eagle.
For Jeff Miller and the Talking Tigers podcast, brought to you by Alabama Public Health, I'm Andy Burcham. Be strong and be courageous. War Eagle.